And I don't feel that it is all my mistake. But I don't say that it isn't all yours. I felt very low, yes, last time when it appeared that next to no one of you connected any meaning with the three articles of the creed. Now, of course, it is quite impossible to take a course in comparative religion if even the obvious that your own religion offers is unknown. I mean, if the YMCA is all you know of Christianity, that's not enough. And it seems to be. And I mean, if a person in our days really thinks that the battles over the creed of Christendom have no application to his daily experiences, it is too difficult to talk. So I can assure you, I still feel it is better for me, or the only choice I have, to do as best as I can to go along with this scale of religion as it has unfolded before my eyes in my life, and hope that at one time you can come into this. I don't see any other way of meeting you, but I do feel one thing, and that may perhaps ease your difficulties a little bit, that you constantly are at sea. What I mean by the spectrum of religion, by this list. And obviously, last time again, there was a total misunderstanding. Now, I didn't think it was so very difficult to understand that because we must change inexorably, religion is the attempt to equate our existence before and after the change. That we must remain tied to a certainty despite the changes. We must be tied to a certainty despite our own changes and the changes observed in the outer world. I have been a German and now I'm an American, and it takes religion to be tied to one's identity despite the fact that the most precious thing a man today seems to have is his nationalism. So what is a man who suddenly is not an American? Now you are very childish in this respect. You think that you will be an American all the time. But maybe the time will come where you will be deported, and where people will say you are poor American, because now you are conformist and think that's a sky, it would be terrible. Perhaps it isn't terrible to be deprived of your citizenship. Perhaps there comes a day where, with the Apostle Paul, you will be very proud. And this is, you see, that this is just what you have to do. This is religion. Only a religious man can forego his citizenship. You can't, because you don't know what religion is. You think the only thing to do is now to run wild with American patriotism. But is it? Religion asks certainly this question. Is it not necessary to survive even this change? At least this country was founded on the assumption that it is better to change nationality than religion. The whole era of the reform is based on the assumption that a man must forego his country for the sake of religion. And you do the opposite. You forego your religion, which I grant you was only a playboy's religion. You forego it today. All what you see is what the McCarthy did to this country. Nobody had religion. Everybody played with everything, with revolution, with Planned Parenthood, with abortion, with homosexuality, with promiscuity, with every perversion under the sun, and now they all went for cover and tried to become serious. So they had a religion of non-seriousness, of play. You play with everything. Gentlemen, you don't have not experienced over the last year any return from communism. That's a complete misunderstanding of McCarthyism. What you have realized, and what I have realized 50 years ago, is that a decent person recoils when with the most sacred thing only plays are played. And the intellectuals of this country and all the colleges of the land have played with things that are serious. And the reaction today is not communism. It could have been anything. Didn't matter that it was communism. But people were not serious for the last 30 years. And they still aren't in many departments, as in psychology or sociology. They are not serious. And McCarthy comes and says, you have to be serious. That it so happens that this is communism. It's a very minor matter. You will see that in 10 years, communism will be fashionable. But I hope it will also be fashionable to be serious. And it will not be fashionable to play with everything. And that's, I thought, why you were taking this course. Well, I was very much surprised when I discovered you didn't even know the three articles of our creed. Because the articles of our creed are one way of saying, in a very simple thing, that regardless whether you are a Russian or an American, or whether you become from a Russian an American, or from an American a Russian, which will also become the fashion very soon, as Mr. Field, that you remain the same religiously tied poor person. That this is not very important, what Russia and America is. If you compare it to the sacredness of the one and only identity which men can find in his soul, with his religion. Can you see this now? You understand this? Now we said, the change in space, the change of movement from one place to another physically, from one mountaintop down to the water of the sea when you take a plunge, obviously he's not, there you do not change, but the world changes, the outer world changes. And so we had a first experience, the outer world, the sun rises, the sun sinks, the moon waxes and the moon wanes, the winter and summer come. In all these external changes we want to conquer space. We will not wish, do not wish to be impressed by the change of space. You go cold-bloodedly in an airplane from one end to the globe to the other and say it doesn't matter. And we said, we call therefore one series of changes immaterial to ourselves, you see. That's the outer world. And we show our religion of the golden calf or of the motorcycle or of the airplane by speed today. And the Egyptians showed it by gold worship. But we had a first worship. Man shows that he is like God if he is not impressed by mere change of space or scene. The mere change of space is external, and we show our religion. Perhaps you begin to understand this now. By showing superior, proving superior to all change. We bring it on wantonly, change of scene, and we are still smiling the same Lindbergh. Whether he's in Le Bourget, near Paris, or whether he's in St. Louis, the spirit of St. Louis moves him on. And the spirit, therefore, is not St. Louis, you see, but the spirit is free from space. This I tried to explain to you the last time, gentlemen, that the first outer ring of change which would make, need, which compels us to make a religious decision, to some clarification, it means I do not change. This change of space does not intrude on my inner being. Matter does not matter, I said it with a pen. And I think it's quite a good pen. Because mechanical mechanisms, gentlemen, and I have nothing to do with each other. So I rise to the power of God Almighty by not being not impressed by mechanisms. If you are impressed by gadgets, you are children. Gadgets are there to show that we are not impressed by the mechanical world, that is there to obey us. And that we can telescope it, you can have use a microscope and a telescope for the dead universe, can you not? That is, you can lengthen and shorten this space at random. And it makes no difference to your own inner man. You are just the same, and whether you look into a quantity of electrons circling around in furious speed or a quantity of stars circling around in the same furious speed. This is outer space. And as you have lost this freedom, gentlemen, you are today without religion because you do worship the speed as though it added something to you. It only means that this space remains indifferent. It makes no difference. What I said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't enter your and my responsibilities. You can, as clay, you can knead it one way or the other. You can expand it or make it shrink. If you haven't this indifference to space change, gentlemen, you have coped, you cope with one temptation of life in the wrong manner. That's why Jesus did not throw himself from the roof of the temple down when the devil suggested that he should impress people by his power to fly. As you know, his competitor, Simon Magus, then went into Rome and showed the Emperor Nero that he could fly, and Peter provoked him so much that he broke his neck. The second phase is quite the opposite. There we enter, remember I put this second phase here, of, there we enter the sphere of your and my daily life. Sleep is, and metabolism are its most important expressions. And the frontier between mechanism and organism is very clearly our respect for the times, for the rhythm of life. I just had a talk with Mr. Shepherd on this, and I mentioned the child prodigy. As you can see that the last century had not this second religion, and confused the two, the mechanic and the organic, when you think of the crime which were committed with regard to children prodigies. People were praised for going faster, as though they were automobiles. And I met two people. Mr. Norbert Wiener is a classical tragic example of a fool produced by his father's education. And now he creates a new science, cybernetics, just good for animals. And you learn it all, because you all still worship children prodigy. And to me, this is a horror, a horrid man, a man who went to Harvard with 14 years, never was a boy, never was a child, never was an adolescent. And so then he produces this stuff, where mechanism is mistaken for organism. It's a real through-going tragedy. This man cannot think in other terms, this poor man, Norbert Wiener. When the child finally was born by him, to him, I think by accident, he stood at the door of the Technical Institute of Massachusetts and collected the congratulations, like a little boy, you see, being victorious in battle. Football team. Very touching, I mean, but very childish. He stood there as his own janitor, you see, and said, a child is born to me, won't you congratulate me? Well, they did. Victor in the Olympics. All these types, the athlete and so, they are these people who mistake mechanics for organics. Gentlemen, don't make any of your children premature. Don't marry prematurely. That's your first condition. Don't think it's a beneficial to marry at 20. Curse it! Your wife will run away from you, or she will dominate you. Something terrible must happen then when you are 40. You have no right to marry at 20. But who knows this today? Since speed is of the essence, everything is speeded up, even marriage. You cannot speed up marriage, you cannot have a child born in 4 months in the incubator, and you cannot send a child to college at the age of 14. It's all one thing. It's all a complete lack of organic breathing. Therefore, you get now experts in New York who give people who are sleepless rhythmical breathing and all kind of rhythmical gymnastics and calisthenics, because people have lost their own respect for their periods, for the periods of their growth. And as soon as you learn this again, you know that God reveals himself in your body. We come from this ugly period where the mind was everything and the body was just a tool. Gentlemen, God created your penis and your fannies, and has very little to do with your mind. That's unfortunately the product of your wrong civilization. But the beauty of your body, that's God's handiwork. And he, as he creates an oak, and that's a mysterious thing, and an elephant, so he creates you. And don't speed yourself up, and don't slow yourself down.
So suddenly, gentlemen, everything that is religious in the mechanical sphere becomes irreligious in the organic sphere. The very same virtue to speed up your airplane becomes a curse if you hurry up your wife. Can you see this? That the religion, therefore, is full of paradoxes. That what is good in one field of human endeavor is a vice, is a crime in the opposite field of endeavor. Religion always, quite contrary to this boring philosophy of one principle, which is invented to death, is full of contradictions. Because you are full of contradictions. You need mechanical things to support you. You have to sit on this chair. That's mechanical. So have a movement, an elevator, which brings you up faster. That's effective. But don't sit down in it, you see. Your body has to undergo those harmonious movements as in a dance, you see, where a slow movement is much more difficult in a good dance, as you know, as a fast movement. And it's much more beautiful. You can't think even this. In this country, I find people, that is the criterion of childishness, gentlemen. A child cannot distinguish mechanism and organism. A child will open a watch and say, how nice, you see. And it will put a finger in a grown-up person's eye, and if he could, he would squeeze out the eye. Because he just tries. So a child, before 7, everything is mechanical. And you are the same way. Because you do have a scale of values, gentlemen, and don't betray yourself. You do have it. In which qualities which go with mechanisms are projected into life of organisms. As long as you believe that it is better, for example, to dodge the draft and not to lose the 2 years in the army, you are not a grown-up person. I doubt very much that this is of any benefit to you. I say that it will hurt you. Why? Because nobody dodges an impunity one his obvious duty. But you lose, of course, 2 years from a mechanical standpoint. But who tells you that it isn't much better to lose oneself than to gain 2 years in an abstract reckoning? Still, I find people, I told you this, I think, before, who really say it's a loss to go to the army. Just 21 months, just lost. Imagine, 21 months during which you have not to think yourself and make all the mistakes of this own thinking. What a benefit. But your whole education is the other way around. You really think that the more man is put on his own mettle, the better it is. Gentleman Mahan, the great admiral who wrote on sea power, has a very startling sentence which comes very handy to me today, because I go over now to the third chapter of intent and purpose of the self-made man. And he said, there is no self-made man in the kingdom of heaven. Now the third degree, gentlemen, of life is not just the organic life, where you observe your slowness and respect the rhythm of fulfillment. But the third rhythm, the third period, of course, is where you work, operate on a plan, on your own plan. Very kind of strange that this country should be so much against planning, when everybody in this country plans his life so carefully, and even his children. It's the only thing he cannot plan. Why there should be such detest of the Soviet plan? America, I think, is Sovietized totally. Everybody plans his own life. Of course, everybody's bored stiff, because as soon as you begin to plan your life, you can't live anymore. But work, gentlemen, should be planned. Work is that part of life which must be mastered prudently by foresight. It's a very insignificant part of life, by the way, which can be mastered this way. And the Jupiter, the god of this planned parenthood and planned living and planned operation, is limited only to daytime and to working time. For workday living, gentlemen, plan is all right. A And we call this part of man the man who believes in himself. Self-reliance is a form of religion. The God is inside yourself. And only that's why you don't know who God is, because you do not know that. Of course, every religion has to give some, pay some respect to one's own divinity. Of course, you yourself are your own God, because you say your mind is God. You vote according to your own insight. Now, that's after all quite a big order, gentlemen. How do you know what's the best of the United States? You really think you do? Ridiculous. You just have a hedge. That just believes, you believe that this is a divine hand, and that the Holy Spirit in some way is at work at the outcome of the elections. You can never explain it, gentlemen. It's pure religion. Some people say it's pure superstition in this country. Why should the majority be a good thing? You can never prove that. You just believe it. In my experience, you can never prove from experience that in any one case which you know, majority is wiser than minority. We talked about this, didn't we? The minority is the wise, and the majority is only invited, you see, to enthrone the minority. We talked at a great length about this, didn't we? That inside the human life, it's the opposite from the quantitative judgment in the outer world. In the outer world, the more the better. In the inner world, you see, the less the better. But you have to win the consent of the lunatic fringe of the outer people. And therefore you need the majority. But only because the majority is still made to live the good life from the center, from the heart, which is very much in the minority, in the body. So, gentlemen, here we have the self as the God, as the part of God relation. And that's the I written with a capital I. And every one of us has this religion, and we shouldn't deny it. Gentlemen, an artist or a statesman like Lincoln is divine. And God speaks through him. And to belittle this is not good. Self is not the right word. In self-reliance there is hidden a very deep religion. That God does not leave anybody alone. That he imparts to him his spirit. Maybe an unholy spirit, but still a spirit which is larger than the self. This is pure physical carrier of these ideas of such. Even overbearing and tyrannical self. Gentlemen, I invite you to be more liberal than the liberals of the last era in One Man, One Woman, and to admit that self-reliance is a religion, not a philosophy. You can never explain self-reliance by philosophy, gentlemen, because you have to be first reliant before you can rationally explain it. The man who develops a philosophy first believes that he can develop a philosophy. At the end, he produces a philosophy. Therefore, the philosophy can never explain a self-reliance, because the self-reliance is already needed before he has any philosophy. Can you see this? Never can you take this down, gentlemen. In the realm of self, the religion consists in his faith that he is able to produce a philosophy. If he does produce at the end of philosophy, there's much time in between where he had no proof whatsoever that his philosophy would succeed or would make any sense, yet he believes it all the time. Any man who says, I'm going to be a doctor, gentlemen, doesn't know if he will be a doctor, but he believes it, and he acts upon this firm faith that he can. And the same is with a composer, the same is with a painter. Gentlemen, why does God send all these tremendous failures? Not only the child prodigy, but the poor artist, and the criminal, and the man who is a crook. So that we may see that we, in all these ways of life, act on faith. You never know beforehand whether you become the great musician. When you tell your parents, I'm going to be an actor or a musician, they, of course, are frightened to death, because they know very well that you may fail.
Everyone who begins at 20 to do something thinks he can succeed. But will you? Gentlemen, there are always 10% of total failures, 60% of mediocrities, you see, 20% whom we call successes, and 10 who deserve the note of a composer. 10%, more not. And the other 90 are needed. You wouldn't have the 10% genius if you wouldn't have the 90% ordinary people who tried it too. Isn't that obvious? So, gentlemen, all these people act by religion. They act not by philosophy, because the philosophy comes to them by experience when they learn, you see, before they have the deep faith that they are meant, that they are called, that they are asked to do their best according to their own, not lights, gentlemen, their own hunches. You have this terrible belief in light and enlightenment. Now, gentlemen, we are all in the dark. We do never act according to our lights. Believe me. We never act according to our lights. That's not enough. We act according to other people's lights. When I go to court and say how to draw a will, then the court can enlighten me, and they have light and I'm darkness. But if a man tells me that he's acting according to his own lights, I only know that he has placed philosophy in the place of his religion. Religion is a wisdom on a dark road, gentlemen, in the dark. Philosophy is the fruit of perseverance in the dark. Then at the end there's light. But I assure you, all philosophy comes too late to the philosopher himself. Philosophy is always the fruit of living. And any thought of any importance, gentlemen, comes to the man who thinks this thought too late. The best thing is he can teach it somebody else. That's why you need teachers who mediate and prevent you from having to learn it all yourself. But we have this incredible philosophy of teaching by which it is said that everybody has to learn everything for himself, so why teach at all? And so you are all bankrupt because people haven't taught you anything during the first 20 years of your life. And this country is just a joke at this moment because it has made a fetish out of the fact that you don't have to learn a Latin and you don't have to learn French and you don't know anything. You don't learn the Bible. And here you sit and you take a course in comparative religion without having any knowledge of your own religion. Just great fun. But it comes all from this misunderstanding, gentlemen. Self-reliance in this country has been made into a philosophy. And I tell you, it is a religion. The great difference is that if it is a religion, gentlemen, then it is a faith in the dark. If it is a philosophy, it is nothing but using reason, you see, by enlightenment, and act reasonably, rationally, as you say. I still have to see any man who can act rationally on his own way of life. That's impossible. You can direct other people rationally. If I'm a strategist and I want to win the war, I can, of course, use my soldiers rationally. I can deploy them and employ them and recruit them and train them very rationally. That's all planned work, is it not? Gentlemen, work can, and plan can only be done in the outer world. In the material world. You can drill first-class material. You cannot drill yourself. Because time passes. The decision is made on faith. The error of the Jupiter religion, gentlemen, of the purpose religion, of the Benjamin Franklin religion, of the is that they don't call it a religion, but they are very anxious to call it a philosophy. And so they put, they mistake beginning and end. When Franklin ran away from Boston to Philadelphia, he did not do this on philosophy, but on faith, that he was meant to be cut out for something special, which he proceeded to do and exploited all the citizens of the United States by his first newspaper. If you read his autobiography, it's all philosophy. Nothing is done on faith. If you analyze it carefully, you will have to make your own decision, gentlemen. So the great question mark for every modern man with regard to this third phase is, what can I do purposively? What can I do purposively?
Gentlemen, you can't breathe purposefully. You can't sleep purposefully. You can only sleep if you don't have any purpose left, if you dismiss your purpose. But you can build up the Empire State Building on purpose. And it stands. And it's good that it stands. And the Grand Central. And the highways. That is, gentlemen, the answer to the mechanical world is work. Work is mechanical. And our will, our self-reliance, comes from the fact that in the 18th century, people felt that they were beyond dead matter. They were not under the law under which you live, that you also were a mechanism. But they thought that they could manage mechanisms, anything. And I think any free man does this with great gusto. I think most, the French were amazed when the Negro company drove into Marseille and within fortnight built new roads and the famous tobacco camps and everything. They had never seen anything like it. Here were these colored boys working beautifully with the biggest machines of the world and doing to the earth in France what these Frenchmen never had dared to do. Just kneading it to their, modeling it to their purpose. That's work. That's good work. But here was a clear distinction. This was not self-reliance for remaking yourself, but it was self-reliance for remaking the earth, which is something very beautiful and for which we have been, which we have been asked to do. So, gentlemen, self-reliance is something that I want you to split into two halves. You have to ask yourself, is self-reliance an act of faith or an act of philosophy? In the word, it is ambiguous. The word reliance, obviously, is just as much faith, you see. Rely on God, rely on man, rely on yourself. Obviously, you can see very clearly that nobody can ever rely on God alone, nobody can ever rely on man alone, nobody can ever rely on himself alone. Isn't that obvious? So any one of these three religions is faulty. You have to rely on all three in alternation. You remember my businessman? You come back to the Catholic businessman who went to Fordham and studied St. Thomas and then believed in economic conditioning and then finally had this lovely family. And there you have typically the three beliefs, you see, distributed. In his family he was living, had a living faith, you see, in God. Hello? With Fordham, he believed in other men, in St. Thomas, or the Pope. And for his economic conditioning, he believed in himself. So this turns back all the time, gentlemen, and I think the heart of the matter today is that the so-called religious people have the same bastard ideas about religion as the so-called rational people in this country. Everything is topsy-turvy. This man, practicing Catholic, is an absolute pagan, of course, because he has not recognized that his belief in his economic advantage is an act of faith and not a philosophy. He thought it was clever to do so, it was rational, you see. But it's just a decision. Made from a hedge. Fortunately, I mean, most people are always better than they say. And I want you to quote Mahan for this very beautiful thing, the word, there is no, self-made man in the kingdom of heaven. There is no self-made man in the kingdom of heaven. I think it's a very great sentence, written in 1890, in the darkest moment of the world, when everywhere in the West the lights went out. The downfall of of this country and of Europe can be dated. It happened 25 years before the external outbreak of the First World War. And you can give the facts. Here the frontier disappeared, which justified America's naivete with regard to religion. Space, you see, was identical with movement, with religion, with God's manifest destiny. The French allied with the Russian Tsar, and Bismarck was dismissed in Germany, and Nietzsche went mad. It was a very strange year, and the Crown Prince of Austria committed suicide, and so the bankruptcy of the whole European system of states was thereby made evident. Everything was finished in 1890. Menheim was in an impasse, but you see, why we have to talk on religion, gentlemen. From 1890 to 1917 in this country, you may say to 1945, people have skidded on nothing, on no direction, no meaning, no orientation, certainly no religion. It's an amazing period. And my only advantage is, gentlemen, that I knew this since 1905 when the first Russian Revolution occurred. I had by the grace of God, I was caught at the first moment when this complete meaninglessness of our world made itself felt. And in this country, it was, you had too good a time to recognize it. But there have been people, gentlemen. You know that Woodrow Wilson died a broken-hearted man and said the only people who were right were the fundamentalists in 1923. And you know perhaps not that Karl Schurz, the great 48er who made Lincoln president by the German vote, died brokenhearted in 1907 because he thought that America had forsaken all its ideals forever. All the deep pessimism, gentlemen, of the last 50 years, you don't know of. You have not read The Education of Henry Adams and his degradation of the democratic dogma. All the serious people since 1890 knew that the world, their world, deserved to come to an end. And now it is at an end. And you better take stock. And think twice before you send your children to any one of these colleges of the land as they are now. That's a racket. You have to do something about these educational places. Your children cannot grow up as you grow up. Without any responsibility, any experience of anything. So, gentlemen, self is the Beelzebub of our days, gentlemen, because if you speak of self, you take men outside his real experiences and you make it impossible for him to distinguish between his faith in the beginning and his knowledge at the end. In the word self-reliance, you have this ambiguity in Benjamin Franklin's, or in the Enlightenment, or in rationalism, or in science. They never tell you what's known in the beginning and what's the end. Maybe that science will know in the end. But gentlemen, the faith of a scientist consists in that he says there must be science before he can prove it. And that's an act of faith. Then you become a scientist, you know nothing of science. You know nothing of your own place in science, do you? Nothing. But you act on faith, on the great examples of heroes, of Pasteur, or somebody who impresses you. It's all done on faith, and it's done on love, it's done on admiration, it's done on amazement, it's done on curiosity, but certainly nothing reasonable about becoming a scientist. Gentlemen, take it down. The whole story of the third ring of existence is a battle between philosophy and faith. An attempt to describe everything that Jupiter does, and let me use Jupiter on purpose. You can also say Athene, what the nine muses do, what the liberal arts college do, it's always the same. What the scientists and the artists do, that it is all done by reason, by foreknowledge. Not one act of importance has ever been done by reason, because reason is that which we know afterwards, after we have done something. We never know it before. As far as we are concerned, reason knows everything about the dead mechanical world beforehand. You can say that the Empire State Building will stand. But gentlemen, if you say, I do this in order to be happy or to be rich, you do not know what it means before you are rich or happy. You have no idea. You set out to be happy. Gentlemen, at the end of life, you will say, nobody can will to be happy. I'm not happy. But that may happen. So you kindly distinguish. Jupiter can build the world, but he cannot make himself, because no purpose is known before how it affects your own self. You can say the Empire State Building will stand, but you know that most inventors die in misery and not in happiness. Their invention goes, but they end up in a hospital or commit suicide or in an insane asylum. Why is that so? Because man cannot know beforehand of the results of his own actions upon himself. Don't be fooled yourself. I mean, it's incredible that this doctrine could ever prevail in this country, that man acts on by reason. With regard, of course, I cannot jump on an airplane that drives at 150 miles in the air. It's unreasonable to try. The physical conditions are the same all the time. But gentlemen, whether it makes me happy to be in the plane at this speed, I'll only know afterwards. You can never know this beforehand. So half of the content of our act is rational, and the other content of part of the act is always faith. And this is especially true, gentlemen. The only religious vocations left in this world today are the vocations of the artist and the scientist. And a scientist is a man of faith and not a man of reason. And as long as you haven't understood that Mr. Einstein, for this reason, now wants to be a plumber, because he has lived on faith that science is a good thing, then you haven't understood science. Have you read his letter? Who has read his letter? Well, I don't think it's a very great document, but it's a very human document, gentlemen. And he says, if I had to start all over again, I would become a plumber. Why does he say so? Because nobody who does something in this world knows what he himself will realize in the end. It's nonsense to try. And for you, however, all this is all one big confusion. The practical aim, the rational aim of producing a hydrogen bomb is only one aspect of a profession of a scientist. The other is, who am I at the end of all this doing? I'm a fool, Mr. Einstein says. And that's why he's a human being, because he still can say this. He's a free agent who is not afraid to hurt all the feelings of the people with his false religion of self-reliance. He says, I'm not a self-made man, you see. I was made by circumstance. And if I had to start all over again, I would try to undo these circumstances, because they make me now very unhappy. But most people in this country cannot distinguish the objective, rational product of Mr. Einstein's science, civic research, and his own fate. But gentlemen, what becomes of Mr. Einstein is, after all, more important than all the figures and of his equations. At least in my estimation, it's much more interesting to see how far we can learn from Mr. Einstein how to live. And you cannot learn from him to live if you believe that a scientist is a rational animal. You are rational animals, and that's why you don't amount to anything. And a rational animal is something to be killed. Any rat is rational. The animals are all rational, gentlemen. I have never understood why a man is more rational than an animal. The beaver, isn't he rational? Isn't the bee rational? The whole benefit, mine and yours, is that we can be irrational. That is, we can act in freedom, on faith, on something that has never been done before, and whose outcome we do not know. That's all. You may not call this faith or irrational, I don't care. But gentlemen, man is somebody who can do something, the outcome of which is unknown. And an animal can only do something, the outcome of which is known. And if an animal does something, the outcome of which is not known, it is lost. We are not lost. Perhaps I told you that a Catholic priest has now written a book that the whole essence of religion is the increase of the power of you and me to experience novelty. To experience novelty. That you cannot experience novelty. You reduce every event to something you have that has happened to you before. I don't have to do this. I admit that this class here is something I have never had before. And I haven't. I hope you haven't. So, gentlemen, the experience of novelty is the highest religion of the human mind and of the human soul. That you can admit that this has never happened before and probably will never happen again. But that isn't self-understood. As long as you're rational, you can never experience novelty. Gentlemen, the rational men cannot experience novelty. Because according to reason, every effect has a cause. Therefore, it can be pre-calculated. Therefore, it is not new. Most of you cannot experience novelty by your own philosophy. Because you have made yourself a part of the mechanism of the world. Just as the Egyptians with their golden calf. If a man works mechanics, builds buildings, bridges, he suddenly begins to creep into his own object. And because you work so much with gadgets and with machinery, gentlemen, you take your own philosophy about yourself finally from these gadgets. You think, I'm probably very similar to the things I operate with. This is the confusion of the self-reliant man. That he thinks because the empire state building can be built up, he can build his own life also up as a pyramid. If your man says to you, my life is a big piece of art, it's all composed of marble, stone, and brick. I have built up one floor, my material substance, and then I have married, and I have gotten a family, and then I have built up a reputation, then I have entered politics. You can know that this man goes crazy. Man is not an edifice. Man is not a building of whom you can lie such structures, you see, in a planned way. Anybody who tries this, will end like the people who build the temple in Babylon and try to reach heaven. And the Bible is very, at the very beginning says, I have nothing to do with these fools. I mean, these are not human beings. They are just illiterate. And you do the same, investigate in your environment, gentlemen. Because a doctor treats sick people, he thinks that all the aspirations of mankind come from sickness. Because everybody drives a car, he thinks that everybody is just a little motor. And he then says, when another man is sick, well, his motor breaks down. People speak of a nervous breakdown in Brattleboro and put their beloved wife or sweetheart into such a lunatic asylum because breakdown is a mechanical term. Then it comes from a machine. Now, I don't have breakdowns, gentlemen. I may be despondent. I may have a human experience, gentlemen, but after all, I'm not a machine, and I don't have a nervous breakdown. And the one thing you should spare your wife is the shame that you call her despair over your boredom and your incivility of breakdown. If you say this, you buy her cheap, because you ascribe to her mechanism. And everybody does. And that's why all these people never recover, because it's loveless. As soon as you call what this wild woman experiences, perhaps in their years of change, her utter despair, if you call it a breakdown, then it's a mechanical repair. And then nothing will enter her life which will build her up again, which will really make her feel that her life has recovered its meaning, its affections, its passions. I always feel that the way people describe in this country the mental cases prevents these mental cases from recovering. Why, gentlemen, a man is schizophrenic if he isn't recognized by society, if he thinks of himself one way and the people outside treat him the other way? Is that anything to be called schizophrenic? Isn't that a very human reaction? Shouldn't he try to equal out this distinction? But you say he's schizo, then he's finished. You make these people ill by your impure vocabulary, your irreligious vocabulary. No man is schizo. We make him this way. Greatest case of schizophrenia is a man the greatest poet of Germany in the beginning of the 19th century, Friedrich Hölderlin, who lived 40 years as a schizophrenic. He was so hurt in his youth by the complete oversight of the geniuses, Goethe, Schiller, and all the great men of his days. The only person who loved him was a married woman whom he could not marry because she was married and there was nothing to be done. When she died, he went out of his mind. And the interesting thing is he forbade everybody the last 40 years of his life that he lived in this insanity to call him by his old name. He invented a Chinese name for him and he would react to the Chinese name which protected him, you see, because he could no longer suffer the treatment which he had experienced under his first name. That's the story of great wisdom of the soul, gentlemen. He went out of his mind to save the integrity of his life. Mr. Friedrich Hölderlin is much more intelligent and much more sensitive and a much greater person in his insanity than you are in your sanity. A schizophrenic is not to be dismissed lightheartedly. He announces to you what's wrong about society. He tells you that people are mistreated in our world. The identity is not recognized. What is schizophrenic? To have one identity within yourself and another identity outside, and that can of course go by degrees, you see. In this man's case, it was a great spectacle. And as I said, I think his soul was more alive than during those 40 years than of most of the people who looked down on him as a case of insanity. Gentlemen, you have to learn that the answer to the Jupiter religion is the respect for insanity. That's very strange to you. Jupiter exalts reason, consciousness, so that everybody understands your purpose. He is a reasonable man who will not do anything without money, who will not even buy a house if he has the capital, and so on. I mean, he's a reasonable man who knows the means and the other world, you see, for his aim. Is that simple? He's a wide awake. Now, gentlemen, you have grown up. The insane man is not a man. The reasonable man is a man. Gentlemen, I'm not so sure. Certainly not the insane men have brought on these two world wars with their perfect meaningless suffering. Only the purposive men, only the businessmen of the world have brought on these wars. The most rational of all them. They have brought on the depression. Not the statesmen, not the politicians, not the militarists, just the rational banker. The bankers are the greatest assets of the world, in my conviction. They have no way of ever looking beyond their own planning. They don't understand that planning is only one element of life. This is not true about America. Bankers are the ones counted out in the crisis of the two world wars. That's why the Russians try to do without banking. I mean, if you sum up the Russian economy, it's an economy which tries to do without banking. That's all you can say. Everything else is just done the ordinary way, but they try to do it without banking. Because the bankers of the world failed in two great trials, 1917, 1929, and 1940. That's why the gold is buried in Fort Knox. Nobody knows quite what the gold standard means. Who understands the gold standard as a functioning of a currency? Not the bankers. Now, this leads us too far. I would cite them as an example, gentlemen, of your exaggerated worship of the plan, of the purpose, of the accounting, of the ledger, of the bookkeeping, of the tech school. I have nothing against their function, gentlemen. I love to be in a house that is square and doesn't sink in. And I think purpose has a tremendous place in life. But purposive living for you and me, gentlemen, is just as dangerous in a one-sided way as it is dangerous to treat your breathing body as a mechanism. Then you will sleep very badly and you will need sleeping drugs. Because your body can only go to sleep if you can dismiss all your worries and say, my planning is not important in the evening. So if you can say, goodbye plan, goodbye purpose, goodbye self, goodbye self-reliance, goodbye philosophy, I don't give a damn, I want to sleep. Don't you see that this means that you must be superior to your own mind? You must dismiss your mind. And you must say, shut down, shut down. Close up. As you say it to another person. You must say it to yourself too. And every reasonable and healthy person does just that. Doesn't exaggerate one's own mind. Now, gentlemen, the insane person is somebody, of course, there are two cases, as you well understand. There is the sick soul and the sick mind. If you have a granite bombshell in your brain, I mean, there's nothing to be done. The brain is destroyed. And therefore, I'm not talking about those cases where the mental cells are just missing or mutilated, you understand? That's one case of mental illness with which we have nothing to do here at this moment. But when the heart cannot carry any longer the burden of a wrong philosophy and goes out of its mind, as so many women answer the wrong philosophy of their husbands with having their nervous breakdown, then I am siding with the heart, because the falsity and the error is with the philosophy. As soon as the religion of self-reliance, gentlemen, projects itself into the other spheres, you will always see that the other people in the environment of this person fall sick. I don't know if I told you the story of a friend of mine who was of Jewish descent. He married the daughter of a very distinguished family. Four of the brothers of his wife were murdered by the Nazis because of his on his account. They were excited to resist Hitler. They were tortured and tormented. He fled to England with his wife, so he was spared as the only one of the whole family. And he oozed out, of course, panic. But he had a wife and two children to which he could impart his panic. And he has a philosophy of straight philosophy and rationalism. If you hear him, there's no God in heaven, there's no fear in his breast. He's just a rational being, the famous rational animal. So he has infected the wife and the two daughters with all kind of phobias. And the wife had the famous phobia, I mean, how do you call it, when you can't cross a street or cross an open place. Agoraphobia. Agoraphobia. The other girl had become an extrovert and the other had become an introvert. And they were all very sick when I took a hand in this matter. And the only cure was to make first sure that the three other members of the family understood that they had been infected. They had to carry the fears and the sufferings which this man projected out of himself in order to live is his wrong philosophy, saying, I do not dread anything. I do not dread Hitler, and I do not dread the persecution of the Jews, and I do not dread the internment camp in England into which he was put, because he was still a foreigner. A foreigner when the war broke out between Germany and England, and they didn't know that. Was he really an anti-Nazi, or was he a spy? So, the funny thing is that I have been able to cure the three others, but I haven't been able to take away the wrong philosophy from this intellectual animal. Of course, he's a professor and very highly distinguished and a high judge, and he has all the honors of modern society because modern society wants to have rationalist beings. But he infects his whole environment with all their responses to the real men inside of him, which they have to represent. The organic, his good sleep and his ability to relax and all these things, he expects to get from them, so to speak, furnished. And they are overburdened. You find this in most American families, gentlemen. In most American families, the sick person is the normal person who is sensitive. And the so-called healthy person is the one who leans on this person and makes her sick. I'll tell you the number of cases in this town among our college body where the people are all rationalists and know nothing about themselves and their own real life. It's terrible. Half of the women are crazy. Or commit suicide, or get a divorce, or something happens. And your wives will do the same. And you just look into your friends' homes and your own home, and you know how true this all is. that it is a healthy person that falls sick. I told you, dead things cannot die. The rationalist is always the deadest element in any family. And so he doesn't fall sick. But he, on the other hand, doesn't live. Any person who cannot weep, I told you, is in great danger of becoming just one of these self-reliant fools. Because to weep means to include the rhythmical sphere of one's heartbeat, you see, and to say that my mind has to be just wiped away. Tears just do away with all your rational philosophies. If you weep at the bier of a friend, you are not satisfied with the self-reliant saying, well, we all must die. But you allow yourself to be overwhelmed by grief. Well, gentlemen, that is how you should live rhythmically. You should not allow your mind to dominate the scene of death and say, well, why should I weep? Everybody must die. As soon as you say this, you have lost your living religion. Because you do not allow yourself to enter this tremendous gift which your God has given you, that an other person meant something in your life. You can only get another person out of your system when he dies by weeping for him, because otherwise he would have never been your friend or your mother or your father. If you can get by naturalist philosophy and say, well, what of it? He had cancer, he's 75, doesn't worth weeping, we know it all. You thereby deny your whole relationship to this person. Your organic relationship. You just say, well, I know it all, that's in the outer world. It means nothing in my life. And that's what you all do. And that's why it's the most beautiful places in any movie, you begin to laugh in the nugget. I'm always wanting to kill all these people who do that. Because you kill the Holy Spirit in yourself, and you know very well that the sin against the Holy Spirit cannot be forgiven. And every laughter in the nugget is such murder. At the wrong place, of course, when it isn't a joke, but when you cover up your unwillingness to participate and to sympathize by your coarse laughter. That's not a response. You may not weep, you may be silent, gentlemen, but the laughter kills it also in this other spectators. And that's forbidden. And I assure you, gentlemen, this one great word in the New Testament is simply true. The sin against the Holy Spirit cannot be forgiven because it cannot be repaired. Once you have disturbed the holy experience, you have destroyed it. There's just nothing. If you and another person go to a grave, and you make a silly remark on the way to the grave, as in most people go to a funeral, and you are ashamed of your tears, you destroy also the faith and the love of this other person. She has to listen to this silly remark which you make there, that it's very cold or the wind is blowing or you should have put on another tie or whatever the silly remark is which these people do when they go to funerals. Or the minister isn't very good or it was high time that he died or what's the widow going to do? These are all remarks that destroy the spirit of the occasion. And you all match these remarks. And nothing can be done. That's over. That's meant with this simple saying. This spirit that should reach you on this occasion cannot ever rise again. It's over. You have destroyed it by your cowardice, by your wanting to live a rational life. And there's more destruction, gentlemen, done by these people with good intentions and rational philosophy than by anybody else in the world. You do the mischief with your wrong philosophy. Not the weak people who cry and laugh and so on. They may be silly, certainly. It's not very, stupidity is in itself not a merit, gentlemen. But the people who think by their cleverness to be superior, they are much more dangerous. Much more. And the country in the world, America, is dying from their silliness. Did I tell you my story about Scipio? No, not here in this class. And the World War. Well, I think it fits quite well. When the Americans had conquered the world in 1945, they treated everybody like, of course, outside, like dirt.
especially the Germans. They were very disgusted with them, as Mr. Eisenhower showed. Well, he's equally disgusted with us. He had a crusade in Europe, now he has a crusade in America, so we must all be Muslim.
Because he thought that he was rid of all competition. He stole all the patents of the dying trust in Germany and everything else, and so these were the fiercest competitors, and he belied all the principle of the war by just stealing all the capital achievements of German industry. So he didn't want to be bothered with sympathy, affection, weeping, anything. People in this country were more concerned, and we had a meeting of 35 people here in Hanover to try to enlist their sympathy with the tragedy that had occurred. We were all convinced that the Germans had to be beaten. I had demanded even these Nuremberg trials 30 years before they were ever started. But that doesn't mean that we could boast of anything ourselves. And so I read at this meeting a great scene of Scipio, the Roman general who conquered the world for Rome for the first time. As you know, the Roman Empire has still quite a ring in your, even in your ears, as an empire that lasts longer than anything else. The empire only ceased to exist in 1805, and it began in this year, 146 before Christ, when Scipio conquered Carthage and Corinth, the last Greek province and the African coast. At that moment, the Roman Empire was established as the governess, the mistress of the Mediterranean world. Well, to make a very long story short, the gist of the matter was that Scipio wept on the day of the surrender of Carthage. And when he was asked by his best friend and tutor and professor of philosophy why he did weep, here, the Eisenhower of his day, he said, because when the Queen of Carthage perpetrated her unconditional surrender to me, I foresaw the day on which Rome would fall too. So here was the victorious general at the very moment that the United States of America entered world history, foreseeing the end, the same end for the United States. If you weep, gentlemen, in such a situation, you will prolong the existence of your empire for untold centuries. The Roman Empire has lasted so long because Scipio wept. And the United States of America will not last 600 years. It's impossible because of the behavior of the Americans in the year of the Lord 1945. They did not weep. They just had a rational philosophy. We have, not God has done what we couldn't expect to do, but we have carried out our policy. That's not good enough, gentlemen. That's Jupiter all over. Can you understand what I mean? That in anticipating the end of all mortal governments, of all transient empires, at the very moment of my own triumph, I'm able to inject into this purposeful living that grain of wisdom, that grain of resilience and of reticence too, and of recovery, you see, by which I can keep the mental machinery of government going. I can lubricate it, so to speak, with my freedom that I look at it and say, it is transient. It will never last forever, you see. Then I can keep it going. Gentlemen, the condition of life everlasting, that's a term from the Bible, as you may know, but it's a very practical, it's a very real word. The condition of life everlasting is your and mine not thinking that we make it. As soon as you think that we make our lives, that we make our policies, that we win our wars, this life will not last long. Because you exaggerate the place of plan. Do you make myself clear? I must harp on this, gentlemen. Nothing has hurt me more than in a group of sympathetic and affectionate people in the 45, the absence of all anything that went beyond mere childishness. They stared at this. The Germans were not people. This were not ourselves, our own fate in the mirror. Oh, that was just somebody else had made a mistake. And what of it? We will never, never make this mistake.
Such people are not human. You see, they have no religion. They have no religion because they believe that I will something, you will something, and the life of the world depends on human will. It doesn't, obviously not.
It is a very simple measure, gentlemen, then. Self-reliance leads people into mental isolation and therefore makes them quite unable to understand what is expected of them to do. We would have, of course, not destroyed a dead Europe if we had, for the last 30 years, had been in the rhythm of things in the organ, or, and hadn't thought it all depended on us, whether we went home or whether we stayed there. Just will. That's Jupiter. That's plan. That's purpose. Gentlemen, these were people out of which the United States drew all their human reserves for 300 years. Therefore, Europe cannot be treated according to plan. That's a different story. That's your family. Maybe the wicked part of the family, but still your own family. What I have to try to show you, gentlemen, is that the worship of Jupiter is inevitable, but it can only be a partial worship. Men must have self-reliance. You must jump at your own conclusions, gentlemen. But you must know that's a jump. That is an act of faith, and that you need God's grace in doing this. You're making your decision to become a musician and to become an artist or become a statesman or run for office as much as you do while you sleep. Everybody knows that haste is nothing he can do all about himself. It has come to him in the organic process of generation, has it not? And you are grateful for your health because you do know this is not all of your own doing. You received a forceful body. Heaven's sake, what do you do if you didn't? And you will realize that each time that you meet somebody who has a poor body. This is not of your own making. Well, it is the same with the plans of your life, gentlemen. Life is meeting. You call it opportunity. And for the opportunity, you can't do just anything. Imagine there is a great nation in Europe where nobody has an opportunity. And they live decently and gaily, but they never have the idea that's all planned. Now, in this country, everything is full of opportunity. 9/10 of your life is just opportunity. And you have a philosophy in which you say that 10% of your purpose is determinant of your life. In this country where 90% of your existence is opportunity and 10% is serious planning, where during the last 150 years, if you were the fool, you had to become rich. There's no merit in becoming rich in America. You have a philosophy in which reason is everything. In another country where the only weapon a man has is reason, because there are no opportunities. It's crowded, it has no raw materials, it has no energy, it has no prospects, it has no hope. The people live happily on faith. You know which country that is?
France.
That's a rich country, full of opportunity. France, how can you say that France is that country? Who said it? Have you been there? No, but Italy. Italy is a country where 50 million people live without opportunity. It's a very great lesson. If you can go to Italy and be converted to their faith, then you know what it is to live. They have to live without hope, without opportunity. And for this strange reason, they do not exaggerate the importance of self-reliance. Of your own philosophy. They give it a place, but it isn't the whole story. And gentlemen, I would then say the American philosophy of self-reliance is simply the theft of the god of opportunity, of good fortune. You have stolen from opportunity and added to your philosophy of self-reliance. You have said, as in the Horace Alger stories, you see, that you did it because you were a janitor on Wall Street once and then became a millionaire, you see. when you couldn't help becoming rich because the whole country just grew. And there was oil and oil, silver and gold in Colorado, and you couldn't help participating in some way in this fantastic organic swindle. And you call it all self-reliance.
So, do you see my point? I think that the American bubble of this religion of self-reliance comes from the fact that we were surrounded by opportunity,
frontier, novelty, I mean, expansiveness.
And therefore, this was not rationalized under any other heading but my self-reliance, by my self-making. I do it. When it wasn't self-doing at all.
4 weeks ago, a great soul died in this country, Colonel Robinson. Has anybody heard of him? Who has heard of Colonel Robinson? I'm sorry. I once was invited to his bird sanctuary in Florida. He was a social worker in Chicago and a city reformer, and then he went out in Klondike in the gold rush and became a very rich man. And he went back into politics and finally retired to Florida and established this great bird sanctuary. This man never exaggerated his own self-reliance, you see. He was a self-made man in the official sense because he made millions in this gold rush. But he remained a very humble soul who knew very well that the fact that gold was discovered in Klondike was an opportunity and not a philosophy and not a purpose and not a plan. And so in this man's life, he grew to old age, ripe old age, and it was, you should have read, these obituaries are the best part of the American newspapers, gentlemen. They are the only interesting part, I assure you. Read the obituaries, you missed something. His life is an incredible story. And because it has all the strands of opportunity, plan, will, decision, and organic change and affection and so on. Very rich life. Colonel Robinson, I recommend him very much to your attention because here is a perfect life whose strands consist of all the strands of real human experience, you see. And not just all of this fictitious idea of the Horace Alger story as though a man was the forger of his own fortune. He may be the forger of his own fortune, but not the blacksmith of his own fortune, as we say. So how do you say in English? You have the proverb too? Everybody is the blacksmith of his own fortune.
Forger.
Well, forger means the forgery. I mean, you can't say this any longer. Originally, forger was an honorable word, you see. What I mean to say, in Robinson's case, you have the best American qualities of self-reliance, but interwoven with all the other strands of human life, you see. The man is a complete example of our religious wavelengths, which are very different, indeed. So, is this point understood? What I try to say is that as with the organic, where the Hindus went to all lengths to make the sleep the only sphere of dignity, and where they remember this deep sleep, this yoga business, meant that nothing else mattered, that if you could sleep, you would win the whole world. So in our world, we have done the opposite. Be awake, be alert, be on your toes, be purposive. You see, has been so much the slogan, the idol, that really, as you know, in a big city, it has become a great problem that people don't sleep. Sleeplessness is a serious question. And it's very interesting, by the way, I don't wish to boast, but it's a fact that this man with his three ladies, whom he all made sick, and who is so purposive, you see, can't sleep. And his greatest envy is my sound sleep. He just can't understand it. I'm much older than he. And he says, but you are much older and you shouldn't sleep more as much as I. And I cannot sleep half as much as you can. And he's like a child in this respect. He tries to measure it by yardstick. He says, this man is older, therefore he should sleep less, you see. He has learned this somewhere in some book. But obviously it has nothing to do with the problem of of sleep. He thinks that just every year you see you need a little bit more, less sleep. But sleep is simply the power to know that you grow just as much when you don't think, or plan, or will, as you do when you do think. Obviously, my best ideas have all come to me in my sleep. I hope it begins to interest you, gentlemen. There's the same demand on us to heed the cry of conscious living, and the same danger of giving too much honor to conscious living. Can you see this? The devil is always that exaggerated projection that everything is purpose, everything is will. And here we come, of course, to the next phase, gentlemen, for the next time, where I want to show you that the greatest crime committed is not even in violating the organic, the rhythmical, the growing parts, but the loving parts of the universe, gentlemen. The terror of the modern American world is the idea that you can will to love, that Jupiter can invade the sphere of Venus, that he can make all the sweethearts love him by violence. Gentlemen, in the Greek mythology, Jupiter rapes and violates and seduces all the women. That's a very profound myth. Men, left to his own devices, cannot treat his women folk rightly. He either makes them into males, as they do here in our colleges, where they all become men, or he rapes them, they become frigid, as most American women are left by their husbands. Because a man, it thinks that he should plan life for himself. He thinks of himself as an individual. And then he marries to have fun with his wives. This you cannot. Marriage is not an orphan, gentlemen. It's no fun. It's unconditional surrender. And it is no fun. And as soon long as you consider marriage fun, you mistake the fourth sphere of love for being under the domination of Jupiter. Now you see that Jupiter has mistresses, like the French, and a wife, Hera, who is very jealous. That's typical of the American jealous housewife, or the French even more. The man has his affairs first, and then he has a wife. And they don't go together. That is, his sweetheart doesn't become his wife. And therefore, Venus is separate and Juno is separate. Poor Juno, in Homer, all through Homer, as you know, and all through the Greek tragedy, she is always complaining that Jupiter doesn't do right by her. And she's always jealous. And, as I think the American wife usually is. And because the husband, having a wrong philosophy of life, is thinking that he is master, except in his marriage, in his one, of his destiny, captain of his soul, as he calls it. Now you must know that in the greatest line Shakespeare ever wrote, he says, he has his Romeo say, "It is my soul that calls upon my name." It's a very strange word which no businessman can understand. "It is my soul that calls upon my name," and he means Julia, his sweetheart, Juliet. And there is another word by Goethe, where he had a friend, the famous Frau von Stein in Weimar, and they were one heart and one soul, but not one body, for 9 years. And he wrote a very strange sentence, which is always misquoted in modern times because no modern rational man can even understand its meaning, let alone its wording. They think it always is a misprint. That's always a significant thing when you find that a certain epoch cannot even understand a word from another epoch. By the way, that's what has happened to your interpretation of the New Testament. You can't even read what's there because it's so strange to you. You can't read it. I assure you, you think you read it, but you don't. Because modern men have lost
anything that transcends the first and the third sphere. You don't believe that. Now, Goethe wrote a parallel to this sentence. Perhaps you take down these two sentences because they are the theme of next day's lecture. Romeo says, "It is my soul that calls upon my name." And Goethe wrote to his the mistress of his heart, "My soul is on thy lips." That's very difficult to understand. My soul is on thy lips. The two things, gentlemen, don't believe that you can understand it. It has taken me quite a life before I believe that both men said a very profound truth. My soul is on thy lips. You will find no textbook on literature or on philosophy in which these two sentences are even mentioned, let alone understood. They're just there and nobody cares. And yet, gentlemen, it means that for 200 years, this whole sphere of number four has been, how do you say when you take a lamp and lighten something, has been only looked at or lightened at or, I mean, tasted, illuminated, as perhaps, yeah, illuminated from sphere three, as though you had to annex it and make love a part of will. And passion a part of purpose. As soon as you try to do this, you get all the results of our mental asylums. Gentlemen, our asylums are strewn with people who are the victims of a religion of number three by itself, of an idolatry of the mental superiority of the male reason. Because they have tried to explain love by will. Thank you.